There's always like, you know, like I have this also that like, yeah, you know how ADD works?
ADD? No, what's ADD?
ADD is basically ADHD, but then without the hyperactivity, so that you're like very, very quickly distracted by something and then get completely sucked in there. So like when I like, this is like why I'm actually, I think, quite good at this job and why I'm quite like bad at other jobs, because everything here is like, how do you say that? Quick answer, quick troubleshooting, quick problems, everything. And this is like really what I need to trigger me to like sort of function, you know. If I have a long-term project, then like I will fuck up because I don't like, you know, deadlines are complicated. But when everything has pressure and when everything, how do you say that? You know what I mean? When everything has a short deadline and it's very urgent, this I can do very well, just basically because my brain works a little bit in that direction. So, but it's like now I get an email and I need to switch off here also notifications, because otherwise I get emails and I get like, you know, distracted from the shit. But yeah, all right. I quit my WhatsApp, quit my email. All of the apps are out, so now I have full focus. Full focus.
You know, all good. We can say right at the start that you are allowed to answer any emails that gets like a confirmed gig, that gets a confirmed gig during this conversation. So if a notification arrives, feel free. We're gonna make a montage, you know, short snippets of Niels writing emails.
On my screen, you see the whole booking process from beginning to end, basically.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah. What was that thing? What was that thing that you mentioned? ADD or what?
How do you call that? Attention deficit disorder or something? I don't know exactly. Wait. ADD meaning attention deficit disorder. It's basically ADHD is like attention deficit hyperactive disorder. That means that you're very hyperactive, but I'm actually like quite slow, but still, like, you know, whenever I see a butterfly flying there on the right side, then I can't focus on my screen anymore because it takes my eyes. Whenever there's somebody talking next to me, my complete focus is gone. It's just basically I have like a very hard time focusing. That's also why at work, for example, I'm always like in my noise canceling headphones. And like then nothing bothers me, and I'm like really zoned in on my screen. If I have them off, I like completely lose it. I can't do anything basically, because everything is sort of like a trigger to lose focus.
Okay, I get it. But how does that then help you? You mentioned it can also help you in stressful situations.
Yeah, it's just because, like, you know, when you get a message in that says, for example, like a fly, like. First of all, it helps me because like every flight that an artist misses, or like every every short-term booking, every like thing that has to be arranged ad hoc, so to say, directly, is something that I have because of that, because I personally like miss a lot of flights. I like fuck a lot of shit up timing wise, and I mean I'm quite a sort of structured person because I learn how to deal with that, but I don't panic in these situations, you know. So that's like, for one, I know that, like, you know, when you miss a flight or when you miss a show or something, it's not the end of the world. The world just continues going, and I know how to keep calm and like just how to easily replace that, and also how to make other people calm with that, I think. Plus, when something like this comes in, which demands your full attention, like I said, I just like, this triggers me. I get like completely sucked into that, and then like, you know, I quickly fix it with. Yeah, it's just like, yeah, like I said, I just keep cool and I like completely quickly fix it. But it's like, if it would have, for example, a project that runs over multiple months, it's very hard for me to focus on that, because it's like very hard to divide your time. I just need to have like very short deadlines and like a lot of urgency, basically a lot of pressure behind the work. And it's actually literally the work what we're doing. So in that sense, it actually, I think it's like quite a match. And I don't think it's like uncommon for people with ADHD or ADD to work in music industry, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think the environment is good for that.
Mm-hmm. And how do you then handle your day-to-day tasks? For example, do you schedule your most important tasks in the morning, or do you just do whatever it comes? For example, because, you know, when sometimes you arrive early and then a lot of people come to the office, I remember also sometimes I'm waving to you like, Niels, Niels, hey, Niels, and you just in the zone, right? And I understand like how you do it. For me, I also, I mean, normally I do most important work in the morning because then there are a lot of distractions and then you have to talk to people and blah blah blah. So how do you do it?
Like for me, it's like very important that I have as little as possible things to basically distract myself. So I make always lists with like the urgent stuff that I need to do. I make them the day before I leave the office, or like the night before I leave the office, and then before I come back in the morning, I have a list with urgent stuff that I need to do. And I try to, at the end of the day, always have my inbox empty. It doesn't mean that I respond to every email, but like I snooze most of the emails that are not urgent. So they're not like visible for me, because if they would be visible, they would distract me all the time. But I snooze them, which means that they disappear and they come on my inbox on top again at the moment where I feel like that I need to answer that. So if there's a request coming in that I think can wait until Friday, I don't leave it in my inbox. I snooze it until Friday, and then Friday morning it comes back on top of my inbox again. And then it was like a reminder for me saying like, oh yeah, I need to, you know, I need to do this. So I think that I try to keep like make a lot of lists of urgent stuff what I need to do. Also really block time, like what you said, like for example early morning, then come a little bit earlier, take 2 hours, block these, put my headphones on, and then really focus on that task and do that before other people are in the office or something, just so it's done. And then after that start with like daily stuff, but then also have my phone away, have every, make sure that the environment is as quiet as possible basically, because otherwise indeed I would lose my full concentration basically. But I don't think that's that normal. I also don't think that necessarily there's something that has to do with ADHD or ADD. I think for everybody it's like if the office is chaotic, it's hard to, for example, focus on writing a pitch letter or on writing like what is it, the recommendation letter, or like how do you say that, like these things that you need to make for the visa, right? To just these letters, it like just basically takes time and it takes concentration, and if every 2 minutes somebody is disturbing you, then it's hard to focus on writing such a letter, because simply like formulating these proper sentences just costs like brain capacity and time, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and since you mentioned email, we can go also into like some details and stuff. How do you, apart from that snoozing stuff, how do you do it? Do you normally just archive also your emails, or do you label them by projects? Because I hear all different strategies, like people maybe prefer labeling every single email and then on the left side having 1,000 folders. Some I know just archive them directly, and when they need someone they just search it through the person. What do you find better?
No, this last thing what you said, actually I do that as well. So basically every time when I send out an email, it immediately archives, and then I feel when the person responds, it comes back. When I think it's important, I send it out, and then I snooze it to follow up, for example, in 2 weeks if they don't come back to me. So it's like either it's immediately gone if it's not that important. If it's something where I know I need to follow up on, then I put a timer on it that it comes back to follow up if the person did not get back in time, basically.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because I never knew that function, that you can actually set a timer for yourself that an email comes back from the archive being snoozed.
And there's this email program called Spark. This is really a lifesaver. You save templates for emails in there, and like you click on that and you have like a complete email already written for you. You can just fill in the blanks. You can snooze emails, and this email program I can really recommend to everybody who does that, because it's really
How is it called?
Spark.
Spark. Okay. Yeah. We can definitely link that.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I'm very simple. I use just Gmail and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Okay, but what about some templates? Which are the templates that you maybe use to from day-to-day tasks?
I mean, like for every artist I work for, there's a pitch email with links and everything. There's just like email with like a short... Wait, this is clever to say. Because if like an email seems very personal and like people find out online that it's not a personal email at all, I have this, you know.
No. I mean, but we all get these kind of emails daily, no? It's no secret.
No. Like I have an email with like a basic text about the artist with just some information, like a short bio with like links to the latest set, latest releases, everything. And then Like, basically, if somebody requests information from an artist that, like, in 2 minutes, doesn't really matter how many artists, which artists are, that I can just send out this email because I click on the templates, then the basis of my email is there, and then I just customize it to say, like, yo, thank you for this call. Following up here below is the info about the artist, and then, like, you have all the links, all the, like, latest stuff. So I'm only updating these templates and not every time, like, creating a new email or something, which helps it to be a lot faster, basically.
Yeah, of course, because in every day, you know, we are just repeating probably almost the same tasks.
Yeah, and
also I do.
You can't get like new info to everybody that like writes you, right? I mean, it's like basically it is so that like you send everybody just like the same story over and over again. It's just the different parts of the world, it's just different venues, different clubs, but in the end, like you send the same info. So it would be a waste of time every time you would send the same, would rewrite the same email.
Yeah, yeah, makes total sense. Mm-hmm. And you said emails. You know, how would you explain to your family member or to someone who has no idea what you do? How would you explain it?
So this is actually quite hard to explain because I explained this to my parents already a couple of times, or I tried to explain it, but just very, very objective. It is basically sort of sales, but sales for a very intangible product, so to say. Like you're selling music, but or like artists, music. But the thing is, there's a lot of people that produce music. There's a lot of people that are an artist. Just like the value that you attach to it is something we have to create over time by letting these people play events and just like then up the fee, create like more, what is it, more relevancy for this artist. Of course, there's like a very, very big oh wait, I need to really think about how to formulate this. I hope we can cut
you have all the time.
But the thing is like a little bit like sales, but like sales, for example, for a washing machine or for like, what is it, like say a car or something, you know exactly what you get, right? Like the car drives a certain speed, it has like a certain amount of passengers that it can get into at like, you know, certain efficiency. And with music, it's like you sell more sort of like an experience or like something which is attached to a subculture, and sometimes that makes it quite hard. It's not like a tangible thing that you sell. How would I explain it? Yeah, like no, like this is a bit like how I tried to explain it to my parents, basically, that I'm having a network of people that are also interested in the same kind of music, that are interested in sort of like getting this experience that musicians create, and they know the value. I contact them, I hope that it fits their schedule, and then we try to schedule in a performance. Then on top of that, it's like a little bit that like you can't play too much in the same area. You have to be like worldwide sort of like relevant. So it's a lot of scheduling. It's a lot of sales and a lot of sort of like, in a way, time management, looking at the calendar. But basically comes down to having like a lot of like connections, to having a lot of contacts. And I think that's a bit how I would describe it. But this is very much, also I want to say, this is very, very much from my perspective, right? So, I mean, obviously,
of course,
obviously the artist is like the most important. It's not that like if I have a network with certain venues, certain festivals, that I can book every artist there, because it also has to fit the lineup or something, right? So it has to be a little bit of a match between between the artist, between the event, and like the network that you have, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So kind of that everything fits together, right?
Yeah, everything has to 100%, like everything has to fit together. And also if it does not fit together, you can also develop in a different way, right? So if you have a network, for example, in a certain subculture, but you have like the professional experience to sell artists in that, you can also get like artists from a different subculture and then expand your network in that. If they come with a network, if they come with like some sort of like certain amount of shows, so to say, then you can also grow in that sense. You know, it's not necessarily that you're only limited to your own network, so to say. Yeah.
So that you mean like in the sense that you start working with a new artist, for example, that you were as an agent previously in techno, and then you start working with the house artist, and then they bring their own network. Is that what you mean?
If there's a certain demand from in the end, the trick is sort of like always the same. The way of communicating is sort of like always the same. It's just more that like if you indeed like have like a lot, like a big network in techno, and you start to work, for example, with the house artist, then indeed, if they have some certain demand, then the way of negotiating is indeed the same. It's just like you need to expand your network then into a certain circle of people, in a different circle of people. It's like you expand your network in a different circle of people, but it's in that sense not complicated if you know a little bit how the trick works, so to say. It's actually complicated questions. I need to think quite a lot. Wait.
you just think and I let you speak. We have all the time.
Yeah. No? All right.
And we mentioned a few different styles. For example, which are some of the artists that you work in right now, and from which genres are they?
So I mean, genres are always a little bit, how do you say that? So I would just say basically classic sort of housey things, new kind of techno, and like Parallax is now definitely going back to like, for example, some more old school type of techno with a lot more percussions, a bit like end 90s, early 2000s, this kind of stuff. But it's hard to put it just like a simple genre to it. I mean, like electronic music is quite broad, right? There's people that can play like crazy breakbeat sets or crazy like sort of like house sets, but actually like are known for something different, you know? So it's, I think, I think the artists that I'm currently working with are techno artists and house artists, three house artists, three techno artists. But within that, every one of them has their separate subgenre, so to say. They have overlap, but they have a different audience and a different subgenre within that, for sure.
Mm-hmm. And do you, for example, you're then obviously working with a little bit different promoters, different people, you know, it's a kind of the same industry, but like you said, subgenres. Do you find any specifics of each individual subgenre and let's say a niche in the industry? For example, are promoters from house a bit different to techno, or do you think not so much, or do you see any specialties?
Mm-hmm. I do, but I'm not sure if that's clever to say. Also, I think honestly that it has something to do a little bit with the age of people that are doing that, right? So if you have like some sort of events where younger people are going, the way of communicating is different, the fees are different, the setup of an event with camera people, with lighting and everything is different. And if you have more like this sort of like classic club experience, you also notice in communication that people don't want cameras, people want intimate vibe, this kind of stuff. So like there's definitely a different way in communicating. But yeah, I think there's also a different purpose to these kind of events, right? Like the one wants to create an intimate sphere and the other one wants to grow basically in in the whole industry, basically, because they're just starting up and they want to also, how do you say that? Yeah, they want to make a name. They want to prove themselves a little bit, I think. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And do you maybe recognize a difference when you're speaking to promoter between a very new, young, fresh promoters and someone who is, let's say, on the scene without you knowing that they are in the scene, just like from the communication? Do you know, do you spot any differences in communication?
Yeah, definitely. But I also think that like there's very little people that are for ages in this industry where you don't know via or via references or something that they are existing. I think it's very little that like when some promoter is writing you and you think like, okay, I never heard of this person, but it seems very credible and very very familiar, or like, how do you say that? Very professional. You text a befriended booker, or like you ask, like, for example, you ask within the agency, and then if they really are like established in that or something, you immediately get the feedback that that like this person is going, like, how should I say that? That this person is already around for a longer time. So this happens quite rarely that I think that somebody out of the blue writes me and I think like, wow, this person is like, they know what they're talking about, but nobody knows them. I think this is like quite, in the end, it's like a very small world where you work. Mm-hmm. Even if it's like house, techno, if it's like big events, small events, people change a lot of agencies, of jobs, of like positions or something, but it's like, always sort of the same people that work in that field. Yeah.
And what are some of the key differences you would say that you recognize when communicating, let's say, okay, you know everyone, but from communicating to someone who's been around and is established and to someone who is fairly new? Because, for example, I know when I receive some email or anything, you know at first sight that someone is like new and maybe started making parties, when they send you like this long email for request, like, hey, we are this and that, blah, blah, blah. We have started our project last year and we are working on it, blah, blah, blah. And then last sentence is like a request. And for example, someone who runs a club for, I don't know how many years, they just send you like a date and the question mark, and not even a subject line. Or something like that.
Yeah, no, like, I mean, there's definitely differences in communicating with that. But I think the most important thing is to, like, with both parties, find out the intention of the booking, basically. Will it add to the profile of the artist where you're working with, right? If somebody is very established, they can find, like, a filler which is not working for your artist. And even if they are, like, what is it? Even if they are very experienced and, like, very established, it cannot always be like the best option for your artist. On the other hand, somebody who's really new, who like sends this, if they have pure good intentions and you see that they have potential to grow, it's also fine to support them a little bit with their show. So it's always a little bit searching to see what they did before, see what their intentions are with these events, see what like, what they're offering for your artist, like in terms of money, but also in terms of lineup, position on the lineup, like how they portray your artist, how they treat the artist. So I mean, yes, there's differences in communicating, but I think this is more from club to club, from festival to festival, and it's not necessarily has something to do with the age or like the time when you start doing these events. Yeah, I don't really think that.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned flexibility. For example, when you sit down with one of your artists, you don't have to name any names, but you mentioned flexibility, for example. How are artists, let's say, are in general, are they more flexible or less flexible, or how do you see it? For example, when they see, okay, that's my minimum fee is, let's say, 2,000, but if we see a really, really cool gig, we can go maybe below to 1,500 or something like that. How do you think about it?
I mean, this is like not something for me, right? This is up to the artist in the end. Like, I'm representing an artist, basically. But every artist has their own way of looking at this industry, looking at what they're doing. There are some people that don't want to play below a certain fee. There's other people that, for example, for certain events want to make an exception or something, but it's all about the goal that they have in mind for themselves. And this is not like, it's not up to me to, how should I say that? To convince them of anything else. I'm just there to support, right? I'm handling the request, I'm pitching their stuff, but they are in the end determining what the direction is that they want to go. And I could, for example, tell them like, hey, I can advise them on certain things, but I would not go against what an artist is saying. And I also would not, like, not necessarily feel comfortable to do anything on their behalf. For example, if it's coming down to big fees or low fees or something, the declining offers, accepting offers, just because I think it's the best. It always has to be in how should I say that? Yeah, an exchange with the artist, and then knowing their goal, flexibility is also then like a very, very, very relative term, right? If you, for example, have an artist that only wants to play big stages and they get an offer from a small club, which is a very credible club, and they don't want to take that, it's not necessarily because they're not flexible. It's just because they have a different goal in mind, right? And for them at that point, it's not maybe not that relevant. Whether I agree on that or not, it's up to me. But it's not that they're then not flexible. Every person that you work with has like a different personality and like a different goal. And I think it's like, yeah, it takes some sort of like, how do you say that? Some qualities to basically understand what they want, and to also, if it goes, for example, against what you think is good, to still sort of go with them in that direction, because this is what they have in mind. Of course, if it's too far away from what you feel is good, then it's maybe not the best match. But sometimes people can also prove you wrong. Sometimes my ideas are wrong, you know. So yeah, it's hard to say how flexible certain people are. I think a lot of people are very flexible because life is incredibly chaotic. You have shows that you need to like play at 6 in the morning, then catch a flight at 8, play a new festival, you know, in the afternoon again. So life is incredibly hectic. Some people can deal with that, some people not. Like in some way you can describe that as flexibility. In another way, I would not be able to do that, I think, with such a pattern. So, and I consider myself as quite a flexible person. I think it's just like you work in an industry that's in like very, very many ways, has a lot of variables, basically, and you need to make sure to manage that all the time. Yeah, I don't know if that like really, really answers what you were asking me, but it's like this question is like has like a lot of layers in how flexible people are. Some people are incredibly flexible with fees, some people are incredibly flexible with touring schedules, other people are not. But in a way, everybody chooses to basically work in an industry that's incredibly insecure. Because like again, you just produce music, which is like what is it? It's like a wave on a screen, like there's a repetitive noise coming out, and from that you need to create value, you know? And like everybody who chooses for that, I think already has like a certain type of like flexibility in them, because it's again different than building a car or selling a car or something. You literally just, yeah, you sell air that is moving. to put it very simple, like you make air move on people, dance on that, and like, you know, it's complicated it's for me complicated to answer the question.
Yeah, no problem. These are all, you know, like open questions. It's more like topics to discuss, for example.
But I hope you get a little bit what I mean, right? Because I think that like a lot of people who are working in this scene are incredibly flexible. But also, if you're long enough in this scene, you become like a certain type of stubborn, for example, because you have seen over and over that certain things go wrong. And in that, you get less and less flexible or less and less perceptive. But yeah, it's just very interesting. It's like it's demanding a lot from you, basically. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And when we mentioned goals, for example, and then everything, then all the decisions from the agent and from the artist and from the management, they all kind of are based on the predetermined goals. For example, if our goal is, let's say, to reach 20 festivals, then all of the decisions leading up to that will try to go in accordance to reach that goal, right? And for example, when you are a booker, how do you set goals for yourself and with the artist together and with the management? How does that look like? And to stay kind of realistic, but at the same time, you know, aiming high to grow.
Yeah, I think you always set goals that are a little bit higher than... No, that's actually not true. I want to say that they're a little bit higher than what you actually can accomplish, but that's actually not true, because like in some ways, like for some goals that we set for this year, we're already like sort of over them. So that's not necessarily even true. What you want is to like sort of look, for example, to what at that moment in time is relevant, where your artist is now, and to see how, basically also... I need to think a little bit about this, because it's like what I sorry, like really between us, what I want to say is true is like you set a goal, for example, for an artist, you have like a framework of like other artists that are relevant at that moment and to see how they can fit next to them on a lineup without, for example, losing credibility. But now it really makes it seem, if I say it like that, that like you look a lot at like other artists and try to fit within the category, but also keep a sense of authenticity. You know, but it's like it's working a little bit in this way. On the other hand, it's also that, like, of course, you try to stay as authentic as possible and sort of like gather a following of your own. It's hard to say. It's really, really hard to say. Mm-hmm. But you know what I mean? Because it's not that, like, as an artist, that's like not, for example, the biggest headliner. You want to sell out and just be on a bigger stage. It's absolutely not like that. But it's just that, like, you need to, in a way, a little bit follow the hype and still stay true a little bit to who you are and what it is, what you want to accomplish with your music. So it's basically a trade-off between, like, really evaluating a lot what's playing, to evaluate what it is, like, the direction that you want to go to and to see how to, like, on what ways, for example, compromise a little bit musically, to compromise a little bit identity-wise, to get on these stages. On the other hand, also to push yourself as much as possible and to make sure that people realize that you are not necessarily the next big thing, but just that you're, like, a credible, relevant musician, you know?
Yeah, so kind of like a balance of, let's say, staying true to yourself and being authentic, which is probably the most important thing. But at the same time, if you have some external goals, you know, if, let's say, reaching some numbers or anything, you also must not ignore, let's say, the trends and anything that's happening, right?
Exactly.
You have to pay attention also to what's happening around you.
I have an idea. I know what I want to say, namely, but sometimes it takes a little while.
No problem. You have all the time in the world.
I can explain you very, very easily how I think that you can find the very, very nice balance for your artist. And it does not necessarily have to do anything with the goal that you have. But so during Corona, before Corona, I worked at a booking agency. Then during Corona, I did like a traineeship at a design agency, like a creative agency, where they made like designs for a lot of cultural institutions in Berlin, basically. But they also had projects, for example, that were not necessarily cultural. And like they worked along a way that they accept projects in some sort of a triangle. When one corner is like, you do this for the money, the other corner is like, you do this for like the culture, the artistic part, and the other corner is like, you learn something from that. And if this is all in balance, if you say like, we accept certain shows, for example, that are for the cash, certain shows that are because we're part of a scene, and certain shows that help us either develop in a different scene, we get to learn different scenes or something, or we learn to challenge ourselves musically, then I think that you have like a healthy balance. You know, if this is all in a good balance, that you're not starving, that you still like show sort of like love to the scene where you're working in, and that you still keep on developing yourself, I think these are sort of like the three pillars basically that you need to have as an artist. You know, and then it does not necessarily matter what goal it is, what type of music it is or something. If this is in balance for you, then like you're making progress, so to say. And this is like what I, for example, learned in this company, and this is like what I took from that to also like apply, for example, to my work to make, make this in balance. And then like, of course, it's like depending on the artist, on the type of music, how this balance works. Sometimes it's a little bit more in a certain corner, sometimes a little bit more in another one. But if it's only in one, then it's wrong, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for example, you have a house artist, and then they are playing, let's say, in a normal cool venue for a normal fee, and then okay, instead of learning, or let's say also learning, and they're meeting, let's say, cool people. That's all like in triangle balance. That's a very good point. Yeah. For example, you wouldn't do if there was no people to meet. And no good music to play, no good venue, but let's say for $100,000.
Yeah.
Because, I also saw some examples that can be maybe then a little funny, you know, a few years ago, but it really needs to have it all.
there's also not every event needs to have that, right? Also, for example, when you're filling up your calendar, some events you just know that they are a little bit more commercial, for example, and it's fine to accept the show there. If you then balance it out with shows that like are credible for your profile and then do like a back-to-back or play an event that challenges you musically, it can be three different events or something. And like you sort of like stay relevant and stay like sort of on this asset you need to have as an artist if you like are financially stable and still, yeah, still be part of a scene and still get yourself challenged, you know. So like you can also spread this out in your calendar and in your bookings, but I think this is like a very big part of, for example, defining a booking strategy on how to balance out these three things, you know.
Mm-hmm. And how do you, let's say, with your artists, do you also make plans, for example, let's say also geographically, for example, okay, in this part of the year, we are going to try to explore this territory, and this part of the year, let's say we try to do Australia, like you're doing now for Tom, for example, and we're doing the US visas, and how do you sit down and do that?
It's like, in that sense, like the bigger the artist is, like the easier this works, basically. But you indeed try to find blocks in a year where like blocks is in like a certain part in the calendar that like you use to, for example, go to Latin America or to the US or to indeed Asia or Australia or something. But also it's very often the case that you get one request from an event that's like good enough to start a tour around that. And if that's like half a year ahead, then you start building a tour. And it's not that like at the beginning of the year, you say like, okay, now in say November, we're going to go there. But like along the year, you also sometimes get a request and then you start building a tour around that, you know? And like in that sense, you need one or two big shows and then the rest you can fill up with smaller events, for example. But like, again, the bigger the artist is, the more established they are, and also the more often they went around the world, then you also know there's more demand. If you know that like you have an artist that every year can go to India, every year can go to, say, Southeast Asia, China, Japan, and like to Australia, then you can already block these dates. If you know that like an artist is demanded in the US, you can already block these dates, but they need to have done this a couple of times before. Mm-hmm. And to get to this point, I think you first need to gather like one show that's worth it for them to go break even, build up and make a name there, and then like do this a couple of times until you find the routine, so to say. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And in generally, let's say if we compare kind of like, let's say a regular Asian tour and let's say South America tour and let's say Australia tour, what are some of the specifics you find out that exist here? Let's say also in like the fees, generally in like communication with the promoters, with the traveling issues. How would you compare, let's say, these three or two of them?
It's a complicated topic. Thing is, like, I can say one thing about it is like either you work with a, like a booking agent, like a sub agency that does a lot of the work for you, which is also like a reason why you share the fee with them. And then if you share the fee, then they come with an itinerary, they book the flights, they organize the full tour. And in that sense, it's quite relaxed. If you need to do it by yourself, then it's a lot like little sleep, basically, because like either in the US or in South America, like Latin America, Asia, Australia, there's like a big time difference, basically. And it's sometimes hard to communicate with this time difference. So yeah, that's like a very, very big obstacle. That's really, really a big obstacle. And also, another thing I can say about that, what is super, super complicated, is like every club there also has their own planning, right? So imagine like you start to arrange a tour in, for example, China, Korea, Japan. All these clubs have a planning and they have different availability. And then you say like, I have 2 weeks in September where I want to have somebody there, for example. Then they have like, yeah, I have this night open, I have that night open, and then it becomes a puzzle, you know, because then you have sometimes a schedule that you think like, I want to have everything in China first, then go to Korea, then go to Japan. But then actually it turns out that you have one show in China, one show in Japan, like you need to go up and back. And like, it's like emailing more and more people. Some people have a good relationship to each other. Some people don't have a good relationship to each other. So if you play there, you can't play there anymore. It's like, all of this, but then you either text at night or there's always a day or two delay in it because of the time difference, which makes it quite complicated. But again, if you work together with the sub agency, it makes it a lot easier because they have their connections. They know about sort of chemistry, the structures there on a certain continent where you're working. And they solve this for you, basically. This is basically what I can say about it, but I don't want to go into detail about like any specific experiences because some were good, some were not good. But yeah.
Yeah, of course, all good. So yeah, sub agencies can actually really simplify things, and that's helpful if you're like on the other side of the world, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And what about in terms of the fees?
So also communication, right? I mean, like, imagine Latin America. It's like, even if the promoters there are incredibly motivated, have the best intentions, but I don't speak Spanish and their English is not that good. Plus, we have like a big time zone. We can't, like big time differences. We can't communicate over the phone because we have to put everything through a translator, you know? The simple nuances of saying like, the fee that you're offering is not really reflecting the value of my artist can be completely wrongly interpreted if there's like a translator in between and then like 12 hours difference this email arrives, you know? So yeah, this is nice to have a sub agent that speaks the language, can real time communicate. And also when you piss somebody off that they don't wake up, you know, see this message, then you're asleep, and then like 12 hours later you need to clarify that because they have been boiling in their anger already for 12 hours, you know. So it's sometimes nice to have somebody on site who speaks the language basically to solve that.
Yeah, that's also a thing. That's a very similar topic that we spoke in our last conversation with Rafa. For example, he said how important it is, for example, when you are an event promoter and you're trying to expand your brand, let's say to other cities, how important it is not to try just go somewhere, you know, and it's also good always to connect with locals, you know, local promoters, local, in this case, agencies and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I think you should always involve like some sort of like local scene there. Definitely. Like you need to find the connection with people that are there, sort of tastemakers that like match the type of music that you have, match your events, and make it a sort of exchange. You not just go there to showcase what you do, but you just go there also to like, what is it, to expound what you're doing and incorporate what you're doing, but basically connect the scenes that are doing similar things and find overlaps in them, right? So you just go there, you have certain residents there that fit the type of music you're playing, and then you invite them over also to your hometown or to the place where you are doing events or something. This is how you like create the scene, how you build the scene, and also why people, for example, from different countries are coming to travel to your city to just see the events there. Okay. Or like, you know, it's not just that you go there with your brand and you sell. It's just like also you go there and like you try to find some way to cooperate on that. Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because in the end of the day, if you connect with somebody, that's good for both, you know, generally speaking.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, because they get your audience or your followers, and then vice versa. And again, it helps grow everybody, right?
Yeah, 100%.
So you sent me a lot of links before, which I briefly went through. We can just open up a few topics. I saw you worked at the school Amsterdam.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, what was that all about? Can you share anything?
So, little like then history about me. I wanted to always work in events and with electronic music in the event industry, and then I did the studies, which has nothing to do with that. But I tried to combine it. Like my studies is like innovation management, which was something to do with, had something to do with electronic music and medicine. So it's quite broad, but you just need to understand medicine and renewable energies. Sorry, renewable energies and medicine. You need to understand that. There was business studies involved in that. So you need to understand innovations and try to sell that. I wanted to always work in events. So I applied for an internship for Green Music Initiative that helped to make Melt Festival more renewable, so to say, in terms of like energy, like more green, basically. I did an internship for then this company that advised Melt Festival. I went to Melt Festival, gave a report on that. Then I lived half a year in Berlin to do this because the company that did this was based in Berlin. After that, I came back to Amsterdam and I thought like I want to continue in working in electronic music. I had a friend that worked at the school, so I simply applied there for like a runner job, a bar job or something. And then like, yeah, honestly, like with the background coming from Berlin and doing an internship for Melt Festival, that also helps you, of course, to get into the school. And there, like, I didn't really have that much to do. So I was there really a lot in terms of that, like, I during the week also worked there in the building to paint stuff, to help to repair the building, to just do a little bit of tech stuff in the club and learn a little bit about that. And then at some point I did like running, I did like in the during the week repairing the building, and then I went slowly to do an internship in the office where I did production at the school. And then like, yeah, did a half year of production there with like very, very great mentor, so to say. Yeah, she
was that
really, really good, Laura. She helped me really, really a lot with like understanding how this industry works, understanding how to communicate with artists, how to communicate with managers, with bookers, with everything. Every week we had to do the production for the club, which was I think 2 or 3 club nights a week, sometimes a weekender with like parties that like went on for really long. Yeah, I worked there with really, really amazing, crazy artists. And then like from that, I think my results or like my being was good enough to be recommended. And then I moved back to Berlin for like to work for a booking agency where she recommended me to do logistics and production. Yeah.
Interesting. And when you say production for a club, I don't quite understand what are, let's say, some of the tasks that need to be done? Okay, is that like the equipment setup or how does it work?
No, it's basically the same as like production on the agency side, right? You need to book the flights, you need to book the hotel, you need to arrange the cars. Like everything that you basically check on the agency side has to also be arranged. So you need to book the taxis, you need to book the drivers, make a schedule for that, book the hotels, get the tech stuff in order. If there are certain requirements in terms of light or something, you need to arrange that. Dinner preferences and stuff, you need to make sure that everybody has like their drinks, these riders, all of this stuff. But also, yeah, like, for example, joining artists to their sound check, making sure that their equipment is all there when they arrive, you know, to be there with the sound technician and help them set the stuff up. Yeah, it's quite a demanding job, especially in a club that has like at least 3 club nights a week or something, because like a club night you have 3-4 artists playing who all have like a different rider, they come from a different place, they have different requirements and stuff, and you just basically need somebody to look into that and to manage that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing that you mentioned is like you learned how to speak with the management, how to speak with the artists, but let's say some concrete examples, what would you say are the, I don't know, 2 things that you learned there, like some specifics, how to speak to a certain profile,
Well, definitely, first of all, to always stay professional and polite, no matter how people are talking to you, because you're like, don't mean this in a bad way, but like you're representing then at that moment when you speak to a management or when you speak to like an agency or an artist, you're representing a club. And if somebody says something to you that you not necessarily like, but you might have interpreted it wrong, it's better to just in a very friendly way verify what they exactly mean and to see how you can comfort them without like sort of like compromising, of course, on like your own beliefs, your own feelings or something, but to just always stay polite and calm, because people are sometimes on edge. And what we talked before, sometimes also artists have like a mad traveling schedule, management interprets stuff wrong, and like it's not always that they are correct in the way how they respond. But you need to have an understanding a little bit for the way how they live and the way how they travel and everything. And yeah, I think it's incredibly important to always stay polite and professional. I like learned that they're really, really well. Yeah, this is, I think, one thing. I think the other thing that I learned there is to be very, very precise, you know, to be incredibly, like, when you make a schedule or something, don't leave anything open for interpretation. If somebody sends you a, for example, a time frame, and you interpret that, and you just copy paste that, and you think like it's all going to be all fine, but it's different than the format which you usually use, that like it leaves room for your colleagues to make mistakes, it leaves room for the artists to make mistakes or something, to always put everything in the right format, to make sure that you write everything as clear as possible, communicate everything as clear as possible, just so there's as little room for mistakes as, you know. It's very, very simple. If you don't mention a hotel checkout, people are going to assume that it's going to be a very late checkout. Sometimes not the case. Better communicate that before, because otherwise you get stressed, you know? And like at the moment where you communicate it, it's like sort of out there. People can agree with it. People can disagree with it. But like if there's stuff that you don't communicate or you leave open, then it's always going to be drama, basically. Yeah.
Exactly. No assumptions. That's also something I learned.
Yeah, exactly.
Pretty the hard way. No assumptions. There's only facts. And when you think you know something, double check. And when you double checked, triple checked. And right before you send it, ask your colleague for something to check again, because you also don't see your own mistakes, right?
Yeah, exactly. Ask them to double check, and then also ask the people where you send it to confirm that they read everything, because then, like, you know, you're in the clear, basically. If you are really, really very, like, correct in the way you write stuff, and, like, what is it? Somebody says they confirm it, and then in the end they want something else, then they didn't read it right. And then, like, you're in the clear, you know, you have enough. It sounds stupid to say proof, but, like, yeah, you know for sure that you're in the clear. But, like, this is, like, something that I really learned. And also, for example, with making these time schedules and everything, or these itineraries and stuff, to basically, like, when I started doing that, to send it then to Laura, the person that was, like, helping me, or, like, mentoring me in that sense, that she, like, says, like, this and this look different than the last time, this and this is not, like, checking out with times, and, like, where you think, like, yeah, I know, but the driver knows what he's doing. No, the driver doesn't know what he's doing. Probably he is, but it's better to just keep the buffer that you always have, and not, like, you know, not let it loose, because when you let it loose, a mistake can happen, and when a mistake happens, it's in the end your fault, you know? So it's better to be very clear, to be very strict, let people triple check everything and let them confirm everything. This is also something that I definitely learned there. Yeah,
for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's I think one thing with logistics. You can make 100 flights correct, mm-hmm. 100 pickups correct, but then you make one crucial mistake, and let's say artist misses the flight or doesn't get somewhere else on time, and it's, you know.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that the whole world explodes, but yeah, it really can get messy because you forgot one comma, you know, something like that.
No, it's not too bad, but that's also indeed why you have to, like, let everybody double check and let them confirm it, make sure that they check in on time, that they know their pickup times, that they know their hotel references, everything. Just like, you know, just like, until they get annoyed by it, you need to check it, because if you don't do it, it's all getting too loose, and then at some point somebody didn't sleep for 2 days also because they had to play a lot of music probably, and then, like, you know, they're at the airport and they find out their flight is delayed or their flight already left because it was earlier and blah blah blah, or I don't know, the pickup is not on time, and then, like, it's your problem all of a sudden, you know. And then
and what was or maybe I should say, who was your favorite artist to meet and to work with there while coming to an event? Who was, like, the most, let's say, pleasurable, most smooth experience, like the best human being?
So I think my favorite artist to work with is always Shem. You know Shem?
Not sure. Shem?
Does Herren's Sauna here in Berlin. So but it's like this is, I think, like, I really love this person, like how he is as a person, also like how he is, like, music wise and everything. He's like a very versatile DJ, a very, very nice person to work with, also in the agency where I work with. After he was part of this agency, like, the events that he's doing is insane, like, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of my favorite artists for sure. yeah Yeah, for the rest, like, it's like with different things, right? Like, what was for me, for example, really crazy is, like, I think 2 years ago with the Crave Festival, for example, where I work as well, we had Jeff Mills. So basically pick up Jeff Mills in a golf car was really like, you know, meeting somebody from a different planet, basically. Like, usually, like, I'm very fine with meeting artists because we also work with a lot of artists that are, like, quite established. So it's not that I'm necessarily nervous, but Jeff Mills was for me definitely a different category. DJ Stingray, also definitely a different category, you know? It's like legends, basically, yeah.
A different category, you think, in the music sense or also when you met them?
Yeah, in the music sense, because it's like people that, like, you know what they did, like, you know their background and everything, right? And then, like, it's like pioneers in this music, you know, and it's like people that, like, really established, like, a movement or something. And then, like, to meet them, it's like, yeah, it's crazy. It's really crazy. Yeah,
absolutely. And what was then the next kind of your big thing, or let's say your experience? When did you switch from the school? You then moved to Berlin or something?
Yeah, internship at the school. And there, after the internship was a half a year. Then I was also done studying, I think. And then I had to leave my house. And I always wanted to move back to Berlin. I had to leave my house in Amsterdam. And then, like, because Laura from the school, she knew that I wanted to move back to Berlin. She connected me with Odd Fantastic, with Lisa, and then we did a job interview actually at the school. And then, like, yeah, I moved there and started there to do production indeed at Odd Fantastic.
But Odd Fantastic, isn't that an agency?
That was an agency before, yeah.
Okay.
That was an agency I can't honestly tell you how long it existed, but, like, was, like, indeed, like, a couple of years ago, a very, very prominent agency, so to say, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned production, or what did you do there?
Yeah, I did there also logistics, production, booking assistant, however you want to call it. I think booking assistant is maybe a little bit different as logistics production still, but, like, mostly logistics and production, yeah.
Okay, so, but here you were on the other side. You were on the side of the agency, not on the side of the promoters. Yeah. Or did they do their own events as well?
Yeah. They did also their own events, but not that many. We did some events here in Berlin, in Ulm, in Silent Green, and in Bassiani, in Tbilisi. We did one event. Also in Amsterdam with ADE, we did one in Shelter, I think, or something. But I was not necessarily very involved in organizing the events, but we did them as an agency. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And were there also some key lessons that you could share? Let's say one big thing that you learned there or would say to someone else.
Key lessons that I learned there. I mean, I think obviously the stuff from the school was applying there as well. But I think key lessons that I learned there. I think there I learned really a lot more to, for example, be very, very persistent in a way that, like, I was really doing logistics for quite a lot of artists. And then at some point, like, at 4 days in the week that I was working, on Monday you start, on Monday people are not responding, Tuesday, like, you gather some information, Wednesday it becomes critical, and Thursday everything has to be done. And then to, like, on the Wednesday, every morning, for example, to set, like, in the mornings, actually, at the office, which was really nice. We had something that was Slack. We didn't talk to each other. We were just writing because there was, like, some time to focus on your work. And in the morning, you just write to each other. And in the afternoon, you do calls, basically, which was really nice. But then in the afternoon, I think on a Wednesday, I started calling everybody who did not hand in their stuff, who did not book their flights, and just, like, the whole afternoon just sitting in the kitchen or in the meeting room and just, like, calling people after each other and then, like, just, you know, make them, yeah. It's not that you force them, but just to remind them of, like, how urgent it is, how to hand in their stuff, basically. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I think this persistency is something which I learned, and also, like, in terms of values, like, the importance of, for example, diverse lineups or, like, the representation of subcultures, respecting certain subcultures and stuff. I think, yeah, the
there's an interesting thing that you mentioned. Let's say that the whole team agreed, let's say from 8 to 12, we are working on our own stuff and we are only talking about, talking to each other on Slack, for example. Mm-hmm. Now that sounds interesting to me, because when we work together, I help you on logistics for someone who doesn't know, for everybody. But you are in the zone, and let's say I'm in the zone, and if I need to ask you something, actually it's sometimes even better that I just write you on our chat, because this 10 to 20 second differences don't make such a big difference between the information that I need and you giving me that information, but it would make a whole lot of difference if I just interrupt every half a minute.
Yeah, so that's interesting. I think is like if like what it is like how I sort of like think with like the brain capacity that you have, right? If I have a question, I need to let out this question, and it doesn't necessarily mean that I need to have an answer, but this question is on my mind, so I need to let it out. And if I type it and you respond to me with an answer in the afternoon, it's completely fine. But that doesn't mean it means that I'm not forgetting it, and you receive this question, you answer it. And like also, if you would immediately respond, but you're still writing, you're still emailing, you're listening to your music, you're in your zone, then like you're not getting pulled out that much. And like what was there really nice is that indeed every morning was completely silent. Everybody makes a coffee, sits there with the headphones on, and we just communicate over Slack. And it's not necessarily impersonal because it was incredibly productive in that sense. Mm-hmm. It was really productive. But yeah.
Comes again to that focus. You're focused on one thing, and then on the afternoon you're focusing on, let's say, calling and then hanging out with each other, speaking like normal colleagues and stuff.
No, exactly.
Okay, so we went through booking management, Odd Fantastic, The School. Okay, maybe last thing, or we can open other topics later, is Crave Festival. What is your involvement? What do you do every year?
My involvement is that like I work together with like a very nice guy called Thomas Hayat. We both do the artist care there, and we do this now already for I don't know how many years. I would need to look that up. I think it's about 6 years or something. No, what I send you is already 5 years back. I think before like 6-7 years maybe already.
Hmm.
Yeah. And this starts.
You send me like an article. I'm checking.
Yeah. I think there I was already doing it for maybe 1-2 years. It's like a really beautiful festival in The Hague, which is organized by some friends. When I worked at the school, one of my colleagues at the school, he was friends with the guys that organized the festival, and they were like then like not starting because it was already 5,000 people, but still looking for staff. And they were just like asking us like, do you know people who can do art scare, who can do runner and this kind of stuff? Then I joined them there to do that, and actually ever since I'm doing this every year, and it's like it grown now from 5,000 people when I started, I think before it was obviously still smaller, to 15,000 people, and like it's a huge festival one day. But like what is really sick about this festival is in The Hague, I don't know if you know that, but you have like a lot of like electronic music culture. Like IF is coming from there, with like which is like Intergalactic FM. You have which is like a little bit more housey, disco-y, dark. How do you say that? Italo, this kind of vibe. I wouldn't actually call it housey because he also has a lot of acid stuff. Then like you have the Bunker Records guys who like make like really crazy electro, like very like it's called Bunker Records, but also the sound is as if it's coming from a bunker. If you're interested in it, like. There's this documentary called How I Sold My Soul to the Machine about the scene. This is insane.
How I Sold My Soul to the Machine.
Yeah. This is really
cool. Okay. I'm gonna write it down.
See if I write it how
my because I'm gonna definitely link it down because I love this kind of stuff.
How I Sold My Soul to Yeah man. Yeah. It's 9 years ago. Oh, no, When I Sold My Soul to the Machine.
When? Okay, no problem.
When I Sold My Soul to the Machine. It's about this scene. Yeah. And this is like sort of the start. Then you have a club there that's called PIP, which means Place in Progress. It's a club that's always like sort of like, developing. They have like interesting bookings, everything. The guys from there, they're like, they just have like very interesting music culture there. also now, like what I told you with this, like Bunker Records, Intergalactic FM, this kind of stuff is basically a generation before us. But like now with this festival, right? When I came there for the first time, the office was like in an LNGF anti-squat. You know what that is?
How do you call it?
Anti-squat. So you can squat a building, but like what they do in the Netherlands is when buildings are allowed to be squatted, they rent it out for say 50, 100 euro a month or something. So you get the building and then you can occupy that, but you have no rights. You need to leave as quickly as they say, but then you get like a sick building, you know? And this is like where their office was in the beginning. And I came to their office, we had the first time the festival, and they're like, because it's The Hague, it's next to the sea from the Cold War. They had like a lot of Cold War bunkers, and like the office of the Crave had like a Cold War bunker basically in the basement, where there were a lot of like music studios with like sick artists. Like I think De Niro was there, Ecstasy, this kind of people. And like we did like then, for example, after the first party, did like after party there, like a big metal door opens in the office. You go stairs down and it's like only concrete, you know, and there's like this big sort of, I don't call them, these big Hawaiian dolls painted on the wall. There's somebody playing like crazy, like sort of electro vibes. Everybody smoking inside. Cool after hour underground. It's completely dark. And then there was like these home trainers inside the bunker that like, for example, if the electricity stops during atomic attack, that you can still cycle and then like get air in. So like you cycle and then like all the smoke sort of like goes out of the bunker and you cycle fresh air into the bunker again. You know, this was a bit, this is like, yeah, this like I really, really fell in love with this place. Like, they also had a radio station there, which is called Onderwereld FM, like Underworld FM. Like really, really, really cool. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, and the festival, actually, yeah, we are now recording on a Thursday and festival is happening on Saturday. Is it one day or more multiple days?
It's a one day festival. Before, for a couple of years, they did like, for example, the Friday night, like some more AV shows, this kind of stuff, already pre-parties. Then on the Saturday daytime, it's the one. It's like a daytime festival. Then there's two after hours in the city. I think this year there's only one. And then after these after hours, we would go to the beach. And then like at like a beach club, still have like after party. That was usually like a 3-day thing, basically. But now it got cut down a little bit to basically like more this essence of what it was before again. Because it's like, in the end, it's like a lot of organization, right? If you have like a pre-event, then a normal festival, two after parties, and then the beach event is all separate things again, where you need to sell tickets for, where you need to sell a passport to for. Not saying that it didn't work, but I think that organization wise was a bit much. Yeah,
it complicates itself exponentially, right?
And also if you're there, right, if you like the guys that organize it, they're like I think maybe 2 years older than I am or my age or something, you know. And they need to be from Friday to, what is it, Sunday night, basically awake to organize all this kind of shit. This whole group. And like this was in the first years was really fun. In the last years, like I think they also like are like maybe just focus on the core and then try to expand the core instead of like doing like AV show here, then like another event there, this kind of stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm. So you're gonna do artist care, right?
Yeah. Only at the daytime event though, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And do you have, for example, any previous, I mean, now it's Thursday, events is on Saturday. Do you have any information, let's say, on the arrival times or how do you prepare yourself for that?
It's like a huge festival, right? I think there's 5 or 6 stages or something. We do this with 2 people. There's an incredibly elaborate briefing with like... what's all in there, every contact of every artist in there, like you get like a walkie, you know, and like the channels you already know where like the central post is, where like the security is, where the medics are, all of this kind of stuff. You have a plan or like a map of the festival ground and everything is completely described. It's like, yeah, in that sense there's already a lot of preparation. Also, I of course have a street sheet with complete driver schedule and everything, so I know already when people arrive. This is a very good thing about the Netherlands, honestly, because the drivers are very punctual there, which is really good.
But what are they?
They're very punctual. They're like drivers and like pickups and everything is usually always incredibly punctual, so that's chill. Like you have a shift. Yeah, this is like very well organized. Also, I arrive on the Friday night at 8. Then we go with the crew already one time over the festival area. We walk next to all the stages and double check all the equipment is there, that all the drinks are there, and all this kind of stuff.
Get it. So I have a lineup here with me very quickly. Ben Ufo, DJ Heartstring, Fiak, Hector Oak, Small Grab, SPF DJ, Daria Kolosova, names like that. Do you already know with who you will be in contact?
No, not really. It depends a little bit. Like I said, we do this with two people, right? And we have a driver schedule. And usually we just start and then we just see what car arrives, what DJ is ready. And like there's, of course, because we do this already for a couple of years, a couple of DJs where, like, for example, Thomas has more connection with, or I have more connection with, or something. But it's usually like you pick a DJ up, you exchange phone numbers, and then when they want to leave, they text you when they need to like have new drinks, or when they feel like when they want to have some company or something. You just join them. But this is like, yeah, we have both one of these gators. We drive around the whole day, and when somebody needs something, we just drive there. They have both our phone numbers, so in that sense there's not really like that much of a division. But it's also, I think, because we're doing this already for 7-8 years, that we also like are quite easy with coordinating this, right? Like mm-hmm. I don't think we ever got any negative feedback or something, because I think we both are very very active people, very easy on our feet, very quickly going from one person to another, very, you know. Yeah, it's like, basically we practice this enough or something to not make like really like a division. It's just sometimes when you see like, this is really an artist that I want to meet, that you say like, okay, let me please, you know, take this one, because I like, yeah, it's just like sick to personally meet them or something, you know, but that's more it.
You want to share any names you are looking forward to meet, yeah, or?
For this year, who? No, yeah, I mean, like, of course, the Fiat guys, I think, will be sick. What else is there? Let me quickly take this.
Yeah, you can open it. I can send you the link.
Oh, I have it here as well. Wait, Crave, The Hague. See, this is how bad I am. That I actually already, like, know who's playing there, but now I need to double check to see if it's actually correct. Yeah, like Ben UFO, 100%. Let's see who else. Schler, I would like to meet. For the rest, I think most of them I actually met already in weird way. Yeah. Midland is also a crazy, crazy artist, honestly. I really love him as well.
Nice.
Yeah, I think most of them have sort of met already or know them already a little bit, honestly.
Nice. I see Laura Croft from Swax.
Yeah, you're a legend. You're a hero.
What?
Because you're every time when Francois X is in Berlin, you go to visit them, no?
Yeah, I was on Francois this weekend, actually. I woke up in the middle of the night. You know, I told you, I woke up in the middle of the night. His set was from 3 to 6. I went to the club, I drank 2 coffees and a Red Bull, and I thought, okay, I'm going to have so much fun. But then I was just like anxious for 3 hours. Yeah. So don't do that, kids.
I'm not.
No, I'm not joking, but yeah.
You never had this, like, I mean, you do events as well, right? That you like sort of... I had this sometimes that, like, you call with a DJ or something and they're there, like, in their studio. Everything is completely dark. They're just sitting there with a joint or with a beer or something. And you have a video call. You never have this sort of... They, like, you know... They live in different time zones sometimes. And it's like... It's like you call them. It's like a bright day. And there's, like, just darkness around them. Just sitting there with a hoodie, smoking a joint. And, like, you know...
Getting inspirational, no?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So Crave Festival. Yeah, my friend was actually Max, who will edit this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
He was planning to go.
Mm-hmm. Why didn't he not go? Why didn't he go?
Work. Yeah. You know, I would like to ask you, let's say we covered most of the topics that we kind of planned through our conversation. I really liked it. Let's say for an ending, Let's say you work in the music industry and you kind of have a lot of understanding about it, of course. Then on the other side, there's people, let's say our parents, who know actually zero about it. And it's actually a bit hard to explain like what you do, what we do. And then there's probably some people in the middle, for example, who go to parties, who kind of are associated with this industry and with this environment. But they think that they know what's going on in the back. What would you say are some of the biggest misconceptions about working in the music industry in general, or let's say specific topic like bookings or event organization?
So like, first of all, like what's one of like the most biggest misconceptions is that like this work is only party, right? Because it's not only party. There's a lot of people that start working in that because they want to go out all the time. But if you want to go out all the time, it's easier to be a visitor than to actually work in the industry, because the longer you work in that, it's I think like being a movie director or something, right? At some point you analyze everything so much that you can't enjoy a movie anymore because you realize how it's made. You see sort of like certain flaws or something. Like you check with every event production and you think like, okay, this is shit organized, this is sick, this I need to copy, this kind of stuff. So like it's actually
exactly
good to be,
exactly.
It's good to be a visitor, honestly, and it's sometimes also good to not I mean, I miss this sometimes. The reason why I started working in this industry is because I love going to these events. You know, I just went to these events a lot. And at some point I said, like, I want this to become my life. And then I started working it, and I realized that the more and more events you're going to, the more they become networking, the more you look at the productions, you look at other artists, you try to go there to network, to connect or something. So I think one of the big misconceptions that people have is that, like, for example, I have this also, like, very honestly with my girlfriend. When I go a weekend to join a DJ, I'm not going there to party. I'm going there to indeed meet people. I'm going there to support the artist, to make sure that everything is going as it is going, or like as it's supposed to go. Because if you go there to party, it will all go wrong, basically. So I think this is a very, very big misconception, honestly. On the other hand, what you said, like the people that are in between, that are just enjoying these events, but are not necessarily in this industry, they make this industry, right? You need them. You need these people you need the most, because they're buying the tickets. They go to the event. They support the DJ. They're buying the merch. They like the music. They're being influenced by that. And they also maybe have a life where they don't want to know everything. They just want to experience this event. And this is actually where you make it for. So I think, like, yeah, these people, the more you have of them, the better it is, right? This is like the best position to. Yeah, not the best position to be in, because for me, I want to work in that. But like, you need 100 people, 1,000 people, 2,000 people to basically make sure that I can do my work, to make sure that the DJ is surviving, to, you know? Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, it's interesting because these people sometimes... Wait, I'm trying to smoke next to the camera. Sometimes you think, you know, that people that go to events, that you think, like, how is it possible that you enjoy this type of event but can also go to a rock concert, you can go to a hardcore show, this kind of thing. On the other hand, it's very nice that there's people that say, like, I want to now go to a techno event, that just know a lineup, that know certain type of DJs, and also go there to be surprised, to, like, to just experience this music and to not know everything about this. It's like what you make this for. When I was working at, like, when I was doing my internship here in Berlin for Melt, we focused then on sustainable energy for a festival, for example. But like, one of the outcomes of this, or one of the realizations that I have, is that like an event, or especially a festival, is like you build a small city for 3 days where people can experiment with whatever. They can experiment with drinks, with drugs, sexuality, with like how they want to dress themselves. They can experience different types of music and experience different things from each other. And it's very nice that you can create some sort of like a small society for 3 days where people can experiment with that. And we were then experimenting there with, for example, how to make this festival more sustainable. And people are, at these occasions, very receptive for experimenting with their appearance, with experimenting with food, with drugs, with other people, with their, yeah, with everything. And I think this is like really, really, really beautiful. So I think actually that, like, this category that you described, that doesn't know everything, but is like involved in this is like, yeah, they are what is making this industry. They are what is providing the artists with a career, with you and me. They're providing them with a job, and they're the most important thing there is, basically. You know, because without them, this industry and this scene would not exist, so to say.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I think you wrapped it up pretty nicely. And okay, maybe for an ending, let's say there's someone who is then who thinks they want to start in the music. Let's say they just go to party.
Uh-huh.
What would you say to them? How to start, for example? What would be, let's say, the first step? Who to contact? Who to call? How to call? What to say? Just where to start if you want to make a living from any parts of the music? You start exploring.
It's, I think, for everybody different, you know. It depends a little bit on what position you start with. If you know musicians in your surrounding, for example, it's already easier. I can tell you, for example, how I started with this. It's like I was living in a very small village in the Netherlands. And then, like, at some point, I realized, like, this stuff with festivals, I always really loved that. I went, for example, from my village, it's, like, very close to Venlo. From there, I always went to Nijmegen, to Doornroosje, to the FNR in Eindhoven. Nijmegen and Doornroosje was always dub music, techno music. I saw, like, I think Mala there for the first time, like, amazing dub artists. I saw Marshall Detman there. Then I went to Eindhoven. I saw their Black Sun Empire, this kind of stuff. And, like, I was really, really, like, convinced that this is something, like, what, like, I want to continue in working, for example, because I really like it that much. Then I went to look for an opportunity in how to work on events. And there was a company which was close to my hometown that was renting out these toilets to festivals. And I started as cleaning toilets on, like, DEFCON festival, for example. You know DEFCON festival?
No shit.
It's a fucking huge hardcore festival.
Yeah, I know DEFCON, but how you started?
Yeah, I went to Lowlands, okay, to DEFCON, to what else? There's, like, these festivals. And then, like, I thought, like, I just need to have an in the music industry. And it sounds really, really stupid. But, like, I just put, like, I did bar shifts, volunteer shifts at music festivals. And then, like, I put every experience that I have with the festival, like cleaning toilets, doing at the bar, being a runner, this kind of shit. I put it over my resume. And then I apply for a company to say, like, I have a lot of affinity with festivals. And then, like, they ask you, like, what kind of affinity you have? And then, like, you say, like, these kind of festivals I work at. And then, like, the function is not necessarily mattering. It just shows you that you're really dedicated to work in that. And then, like, they ask you a little bit about, like your what is it, like, your preferences, your music, this kind of stuff. And then, like, if you're being persistent enough, you know, not in an annoying way, but just show that, like, you really are willing to work in that, at some point somebody's going to hire you in a club or, like, on a festival or something, and you're going to start very low, and, like, basically you work your way up. That's a bit how it works, unfortunately, because there is no study. You can't study, like, to become a festival booker. You can't study to become a booking agent or something, you know. It's an industry that's, like, grown from subcultures, and it's like an industry that creates its own sort of, like, economy, basically. Like, the things how we work, for example, we're working with a club, like, bands don't work that way. If you work for an agency that works with rock bands, they work completely different. You know, this industry we basically created, and it's growing, it's evolving, and you basically evolve with that. And, like, the longer you're in it, the more you, yeah, the higher up you get, hopefully. Yeah. But again, it's for everybody different. If you have, like, a very clear understanding of what you want to do, you already know a couple of DJs, you can join these DJs, you can network, and, like, you can also, in that sense, roll into that, right? It's like you can also start with music, you can start playing music, and then meet other people, meet producers, find out, for example, what it is that you really like in this industry, because it's honestly quite complicated. Like, you have labels, you have management, you have booking management, you have PR, there's so many different facets, and, like, it's also complicated from the outside to see, for example, what a booking agent does, what an artist management does, what PR does, or something. It's like you need to be in it for a long time to understand a little bit how it works, and then find your way in that, basically. And how you start is basically by going to events, meeting people, and no matter how you do that, this is like, yeah, being there, showing your face, supporting the collectives that you want to support, grow with them, basically. Yeah.
Well, probably this was the best answer that you gave out of all. All right.
Thanks.
Yeah, no, really. I mean, you summarized everything, but if you allow me to summarize you, so like be proactive, but be genuinely proactive. Yeah. You know, you can always ask nicely. There's nothing wrong with asking nicely. For example, does anybody need work? You know, coming to event, hey, can I do this? Can I do that? Yeah. Writing to people, being, again, repeating myself, proactive. And then just start gathering all of this experience, you know, obviously for free. And then you gather all of this experience, and then you all of a sudden have something to present, you know, to go to the next step.
If you're just sincere, if you just ask this to people that you know in the industry, I think they will also help you. I have this also sometimes from people that want to do a similar job, or like that artists that want to grow to a certain level. They write me on LinkedIn and they ask me, can I do a call? Then we have a call and I just like, what is it? We sit down half an hour and then I just explain them what my experiences are, or like what I think that they should improve, how I think that they should act. And it's not that I'm having a success formula. I'm just like basically repeating how this went for me, and then like helping people with that. And I think that like, also because it's like, it seems like a very close scene, but everybody in there is like doing this because it's something that they love. And if you show that you like sort of have this love, but like you don't know necessarily how to grow to that, you can always reach out to people, approach them. If the first person ignores you, just ask it to a different person. At some point you find somebody that helps you with the in, that can refer you, that can just, yeah, indeed be genuine and be proactive in that. That's like indeed like the key takeaways basically. Yeah.
Have you heard this saying? If you sit in front of a hair shop, sooner or later you're gonna get a haircut.
Yeah.
So basically, it goes similar here. You know, if you're just proactive, you keep pushing, you keep trying, and that's it.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So yeah, I think we wrapped it up pretty nicely. I'd like to thanks a lot for this very insightful conversation. We can still chat a little bit, but then I have to go. So yeah, thanks again.
So I'm gonna tell Luke to come here, but like thanks a lot.
Sure, pleasure.